of theater attendees. Anyway, Susan, hi, good afternoon.
Hey, Alan, welcome. We made it through successfully, Radiothon 2022. What a week that was last week. Oh, my goodness. We thank our loyal donors from this past week of donations. And just, you know, if it's not too late, if it slipped your mind or
and
if
there's
you're
that, yeah,
I'm going to do this, but I just didn't yet. We are certainly always open to taking your donation to help in this year's cycle to sort of help replenish that rainy day fund that we had to dip heavily into to provide you with the best listening opportunity and experience with some new equipment. So feel free, go to our website, whfr.fm. You'll find all the details on how to make a contribution. Thank you in advance for all the support that you have shown and continue to show us at WHFR.
All right. So with that out of the way, let's get to what we're going to talk about today. And well, let's see. You know, there are, as always, certain like rituals, certain things that happen. And we know that there are certain activities that take place certain times of the year. And for our students here at Henry Ford College, it means a lot of things, especially for those in the performing arts area. And I guess we're going to, like I said, we're going to put a little spotlight on that today on the program, aren't we?
We are. And it's interesting when I hear the title of the upcoming production that the HSC Theater Department is offering. As a woman, it gives me a sense of panic sometimes. The title of the upcoming production is Five Women Wearing the Same Dress. And that's our worst nightmare as women. You know,
that's a no-no, right? Yeah,
Well, when it comes to certain circumstances, it's logical, expected, and appropriate, and that would be, for example, bridesmaids in a wedding or whatever fun thing we're doing. And this particular production is no exception. But we are so excited to welcome back the theater program at Henry Ford College in their first official performance, Five Women Wearing the Same Dress. It kicks off in about a little under 2 weeks. So it starts April 28th and goes through the end of the first week of May. So April 28th through May 8th. And this is such a big deal, Alan. It's so important and necessary that we are resurrecting all of the wonderful things that for so many years have taken place through the HSC Theater Department, that we thought we would bring in the main person himself, who is going to speak to this production, but also how important theater is in life, in the life of our campus community and our students, and hopefully in that of those that are going to come to see the show. So we are welcoming to our airwaves Christopher Bremer. Chris is with us. He is the director of this particular production and has directed many productions before this here at Henry Ford College and otherwise, very involved with the Jet Theater, award-winning director. And Chris, when I think theater at HFC, your name of course pops to the top of my list. It seems like everything that you're involved with is successful. And that's a wonderful reputation that you carry, whether you kind of realize you've got that pull or not, but you do, I'll just tell you. and so we are so excited that you are bringing back that skill set as you did with, you know, Ruined. And then there were none, the Playboy of the Western World, even A Raisin in the Sun, which was dynamic. So you're coming back and you've got Five Women Wearing the Same Dress. So tell us about how important this whole thing is as we are coming back metaphorically and literally to the theater.
Susan and Alan, thank you guys so much for having me. Yes, I'm very, very excited. Not only for the, I don't want to say resurrection of the theater department. It's sort of the, we're coming out of our dormancy. We've all been through a heck of a lot in the last few years. So we are really, really excited to be back and in person and creating the art that we love and that, frankly, Henry Ford is known for. I mean, when you consider all of the other arts that are supported and taught at our university, it is amazing and wonderful. Now, I'm really excited about Five Women Wearing the Same Dress. This play is very funny, but very poignant, too. And I know this is going to sound odd, and because it sort of dawned on me a little bit ago that actually, even though this play was written in the late 80s. Well, frankly, we're doing a period piece. That's over 40 years ago.
Oh, and, hold on. No, that's just, that's making me feel way too old, but okay. I'll follow you. All right. I like it. It's a period piece.
But yeah. You know, one of the beauties of doing theater and when you're doing shows that are older is it gives you a real opportunity to see how we lived back then and be able to compare to where we are today and how have the mores changed the customs. And it's really exciting to see how much things change, but they also stay the same too. So that's one of the reasons that I chose this show, just so that we kind of don't forget about how we were in the past, and so that we all get a real good sense of perhaps where we're going. But most importantly is that we have a little fun and catharsis when we pick these shows and you come out and participate. A lovely cast, really, really great to work with the administration here. And we're so excited to have people back in the room. Now, speaking of the room, we are going to be, I apologize for all the ums. We're going to be doing some social distancing. We've got to be very careful, of course.
Sure.
And so we're going to have a row in between each of the rows. So we're doing this in the Edre Auditorium, which seats 400 people. In years past, we've done productions where we had the audience sit on the stage with the actors. So you'd have about 60 people, real intimate, neat performance. But not really so much good for the COVID world that we're
fair
in.
Enough. So yes,
we're going to have a seat, a row in between everyone, and then we'll have a couple seats in between each group. You can buy tickets online at the HFCC website, and we're real excited about bringing this back. So what else can we? And I answer for y'all.
Yeah, I'm excited. Oftentimes when students of the craft of theater are introduced to a play that they can't relate to or have never heard of anybody related to it, connected with it or anything, it can be a bit of a learning curve to try to get people excited about wanting to actively participate in it or wanting to come to it to enjoy. But when we talk about the writer, the original writer-director of Five Women Wearing the Same Dress, that's Alan Ball. And anybody that knows film knows that he's also responsible for American Beauty, which was an Academy Award winning, film. A beautiful story, difficult, challenging, but also quite wonderful. In addition, he has some TV under his, in his repertoire as well with True Blood, Six Feet Under. So this is not a play that was written by a novice who just decided to try something and we're just testing it out. I mean, this is tried and true stuff. So we know that the narrative is going to be wonderful. We know that you put, as you indicated, put time into making the right choice for this coming back into the theater world with HFC. And you also went with something that's comedic, which I think is wonderful. And I think probably makes a lot of sense. So sort of that female spirit, but we can laugh, we can heal through laughter. And it really is one of the things that brings people back together. So who would you say, Chris, would be the ideal audience member? I mean, it's not all women. It's not all, young women. It's not all, any one thing. I think this speaks to a lot. But who do you think is going to really, really enjoy this production?
Well, frankly, I think anybody who has any inclination to walk into a space and be entertained. Frankly, I mean, this play has something for everybody. We all see ourselves and our personalities in each of these characters and the situations that they're put in. Quite frankly, we come across them, maybe not exactly in the same situation, but they happen to us all the time. And so we can relate to everyone and what's going on. And so it's a fun journey in what you'll remember about yourself and what's happened in your life. I encourage anybody who has a desire to participate in producing theater to come and observe it, because there's a place for everybody. No matter what your skills, talents, levels are, you just have to have a love for the theater. And maybe you don't even know that you've got a love for it, but you're wanting to try something new. It is, frankly, it's an experience that you can't get in anything else you do in life. We all look at many different ways to entertain ourselves and inform ourselves, with the social media, you watch television, you live stream, you do all that. But here's the thing. in all of those forms of entertainment that we consume, there's a filter, right? So right now we're talking on Zoom and we see each other and we can, you know, make eye contact and you can see the expressions on my face. But what you can't feel is what I'm feeling. And when we come into the same room together and there's no filter, there's no screen, there's no phone, and it's you and me and the actors and the other audience members, we're creating something that is going to happen only one time ever. Even though we'll do 8 performances of this show, every show will be different and it's ephemeral. So it's this moment that you can have one time and then that's it. Even when you come back, it's not going to be the same moment. Okay. So it's, if you want to give something a real interesting new try, do it, because you won't be disappointed. And the fact is you've got to be a little bit daring, and a lot of people, you know, I would say, you know, and so I'll challenge your audience. I bet a lot of you are afraid to come in there because you don't want to feel.
I wonder how the actors feel, because I mean, it's not just one person walking that tightrope. At least based on the title of the play, there's at least 5 people walking that tightrope. So a little bit about the concept of the play and the setup. I mean, I can sort of, you know, read what is up there available in information at hfcc.edu about the play, which is called 5 Women Wearing the Same Dress. Susan already sort of spilled the beans. This is sort of like the bridal party for somebody who's going to get married. So tell us a little bit more about what this story is. I'd assume that anytime, and this is not obviously, don't take it the wrong way, anytime you get 5 people, whatever gender or however they identify, in the same room for the same purpose, there's going to be a little bit of friction or a little bit of things going on. What is it that you saw in this? Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, Alan, you're speaking right to the dynamism of what's happening on stage. And so play takes place 1989, Knoxville, Tennessee. So you'll excuse that I did a little bit of Southern, but we've been doing a lot of Southern while we're rehearsing this show. And you have these 5 bridesmaids who have all been asked to be in this beautiful wedding, country club wedding, beautiful upscale area of Knoxville. And so we find out all the little sort of backstories and the challenges that these characters have had in their lives, and how we all came to this same moment here. And we sometimes realize that all of the different and varied backgrounds that each of the characters have, while they may not seem to have something in common, they do have something in common. And, you know, it's a sense of longing for what could have been and yearning for what will be in this show. And
life, right?
Yes, that's it. And that's why, you know, Alan Ball, as Susan so eloquently talked about, is it one of the best writers. And, you know, when you're choosing a play, you start with the writing. If the writing is really good, you got a really good shot at having a really good play. And I will say that our actors and actresses have stepped up. They're doing a really nice job here. And I think people are going to be very impressed and very pleased. I don't want to spoil anything in this show, but you know,
Nor should you. Yeah.
Okay. I said it's a period piece, and we really are kind of looking at the different mores of society and what's happening and what's acceptable. And it'll make everybody feel very warm, I think, at the end of the play.
So you mentioned actors and actresses, and obviously as somebody who spends time in the theater, just like any of the performing arts, to have that taken away from you in so many ways, shapes, and forms over the last couple of years. And then add on to that a student environment where you only have students for a certain amount of time, maybe 2 years. What has it meant to them, and what's it been like to sort of get back on the stage and be able to, you know, whatever, put on a show, I guess.
Well, it's been wonderful. I mean, you know, if you imagine, it's like going through withdrawals for 2 years, and you have this longing, you know, something's missing. And, you know, it wasn't just me as a director. It was all of the students. We were lucky. Frankly, when the pandemic hit, we were 5 weeks from opening Mamma Mia. And we had to shut everything down. We had over 35 people in that show. Everyone was very excited. And then, boom, we can't get together for 2 years. So now it's sort of like, you know, getting the old rusty gears greased up again and getting everything going. But we never lost our enthusiasm. Students were extremely, when are we going to do the next show? What's going to happen? And this fits and starts have been just terribly painful, but okay, now things are gearing up and we're getting ready to go here. And it is really, really exciting. I'm hoping that we'll have a nice attendance, and I'm really very optimistic that it is going to be a fine show that we can be very proud of. I don't know if I answered your question, Alan. I start talking and I just forget what you said. So if I didn't, please call me back.
You absolutely did. And you've mentioned, you know, some of the precautions that are being taken in terms of still having some space and distance so that the people who are coming to the theater can feel comfortable in that space and that environment. And then once they're there, once they realize, okay, this is a safe environment, to let go and sort of turn themselves over to what it is that they're going to see, I assume is the goal. Oh, eight, yes. Eight performances in total from what I saw, Thursday through Sunday, April 28th through May 1st, and then again Thursday, May 5th through Sunday the 8th. Is that correct?
That is correct. Those 8 o'clock performances on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and it's a 2 p.m. matinees on Sunday.
Wonderful.
Okay.
One of the things that I wanted to just talk about a little bit is the rich history with the HFC theater program in the theater department. Those of us that have been at the college for many years couldn't imagine not having the theater just active and present and happening. And it's been a tough time these past couple, certainly without having it, without getting to hear the people performing. And my office is right next door to the theater, so I get the pleasure of getting all the, you know, the practice runs and the music and all that. But I'm going to appeal really to those that have not ever been to the theater at HFC or have never experienced this ever. Like you were saying, Chris, this sort of symbiotic relationship that takes place in that live organic moment really is something that's very special and very unique. And we're really good at it at Henry Ford College. Chris, you indicated earlier yourself that you have been involved in the theater program in some capacity or another for a lot of years. Now, you don't have to give us a date on that, but there's a rich history here and one that for those that have not been privy to sort of going along with it, let's get you in now. This is the time to start. We are turning a corner, absolutely, back into a robust and rich theater program, past, you know, it through and post pandemic, hopefully here. But speak to a little bit of the culture and also the history of the Henry Ford College Theater Program, if you would.
Well, Henry Ford has been so wonderful in supporting arts and culture and theater. I mean, frankly, since its inception. We basically, if you go back and you look at the history of Henry Ford College Theater, we're talking about over 50 years. So we go back to Doc Worsley and George Popovich, and we produced many Pulitzer Prize winning plays, wonderful musicals, and we've taken plays to competitions, American College Theater Festival. You spoke about me. I'll be honest. You know how we have our dual enrollment students? I was a dual enrollment student, and I won't give you my the year, but I'll say disco music was really important back then. And so I did my first play in 10th grade at Henry Ford College. And so I'm still doing it here. And I'm really proud of this program. We've sent people out to work professionally, making their living in all different aspects of theater. I mean, if you want to work in this industry, if you think that this is something you love. And now remember, you know, most of us are going to work the rest of our lives. So do something you want to do. And if you want to do it, you can come here and get the skills in producing theater that you can make a living and that you can be happy and comfortable in your life. But the number of people that we've touched over the years, not with just our main stage shows, because we have a very rich history of doing theater for young audiences and busing in elementary and middle school children from all over the southeastern Michigan area. That history and legacy has opened eyes to theater that maybe never would have had that opportunity. And that is a testament and a legacy to Henry Ford College and how important this program is. And I'm very proud to be associated with it and all of the people who came before me at Henry Ford and all those who are going to come after us, because this is a really important thing that we do for culture, society, our students. And I think it's wonderful that the college administration supports this program as much as they do.
Christopher Bremer is our guest today on the WHFR Journal. He is the director of the upcoming production here at Henry Ford College of Five Women Wearing the Same Dress. Now, Christopher, you mentioned, having performances for younger audiences. I do notice a little bit of a disclaimer that this particular production contains adult language and situations intended for mature audiences. So,
people right.
Know that. Yeah.
Familiarize yourself with the script before you come out to see the show. And, you know, I would say, frankly, if they're under 15, maybe not. You probably don't want to have those conversations with them. But if they're above that, I think that it's a wonderful production that will really give you a wonderful time and experience with your family and your friends.
Yeah, fair enough. And I was going to say, at some point, they all know those words, and they'll understand everything that's going on anyway. So yeah,
but let's keep them honest and innocent for as long as we can, though.
Right? Exactly,
that's my mindset. But you know, the process of getting to see a live play in a theater that is a beautiful sight and done in such a way that is being authentic to the content and being modern and honest and open for an audience with safety protocols, of course, in place. But to do that for $12 a ticket is pretty incredible. And to do it for the Henry Ford College faculty and staff or students with ID, $7, you can't beat that. And of course, we always are good to our seniors, $10 for a senior ticket. So these are, you can't go to a movie for that price. And this is live theater. So there is something to be said about the bang for your buck, if you will, in this particular situation. So thank you for keeping those ticket prices affordable, Chris, in this production.
Well, it's real important that people have access to it, because so many people don't know about the beauty and wonder of a live theatrical performance. It's a sort of an afterthought for a lot of people. But I think, what I've found in the professional theater that I run is that once they come back to it, they're hooked on. So I hope that you guys will come out and just give it a taste, give it a try. And I think you won't turn back once you've done it. And that's one of the reasons that we keep the prices at such a reasonable, a 1980s level, probably.
Which would be appropriate for a period piece like
this.
Christopher Bremer, our guest today on the WHFR Journal. So we've got five bridesmaids. I'm assuming somewhere in there we've got a bride, and there's probably a few other characters. What is it that has stood out to you about the actors that are going to be performing this, as individuals, as students, I'd imagine just like any instructor at that level, you always look for the best in your students and what you're excited to see from the cast.
Well, I'm excited to see their growth, and we've watched a whole lot of it since the very beginning, and to see them mature as actors and to see their performances flower, quite frankly, I think is super exciting. And, you know, we're a couple weeks out here and it's growing leaps and bounds every day. I think that once people come out, they're going to be very impressed with these ladies and one gentleman. It's five ladies and one gentleman.
One gentleman. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that if you're a friend of theirs or you won't recognize them. And if you're not a friend of theirs, you are absolutely going to believe that you're looking at real people being honest and truthful on stage. And I'm very proud of them that they're able to accomplish that, because that's the goal. We're trying to teach these students to have the skills so that they can work in this industry, and watching them attain those skills and master them has been wonderful for me as a director. And that's one of the reasons that I've always loved teaching at Henry Ford College, is the youthful exuberance and watching the leaps and bounds that the actors take as they get better. And not just actors, and it's technicians.
I was
going to
say, the ones
staff,
on the stage get all the glory, but there's a lot more to the story, isn't there?
Absolutely. And so I'm really, really excited, enthused, and I can't wait for you all to come and see it. I think you're going to have a blast.
I look forward to it. Let's the context in which we're speaking to you today on our Zoom meeting looks like you're sort of backstage. I see a lot of wardrobe stuff like that, and just want to touch on the Jet Theater a little bit as well, which is something else that you are involved in, if we can spend a few minutes discussing that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm the executive director at Jet Theater. We're here in Walled Lake. We're a professional theater. We utilize the Actors Equity contract in all of our shows. And frankly, we're opening a show here 1 week before Five Women Wearing the Same Dress. We'll be doing same time next year. For those of you who are a little bit older, you might remember the Alan Alda.
Yep, exactly.
Movie.
Yep.
Yes, it's a delightful comedy. I think people will have a blast. And we're heading right into the season. We basically will then do Amadeus, followed by The Full Monty, and then a wonderful Pulitzer Prize winner called Sweat by Lynn Nottage. We had done, as you mentioned, Ruined by her at the college. And then we'll finish up in October with the Rocky Horror Show. So we're real excited. We have a nice 100-seat intimate space here that we do all of our performances are in. And, you know, it's a little bit more costly to come out here than it is to go to Henry Ford.
Sure.
But maybe if you like what you see at Henry Ford, you might take a chance on, because there's some wonderful theater all over metropolitan Detroit. You know, you don't have to go to Broadway. You don't have to go to Stratford or the Shaw Festival to see quality theater. It's right here in your town. And there are some fine artists that are working here that I think most people would be extremely impressed.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Chris. We wish you much success with the opening of same time next year, as well as the opening of Five Women Wearing the Same Dress, kicking off at Henry Ford College's theater department and through the Edry Auditorium, starting on April 28th, going all the way through May the 8th. For more details, for more information on not only this show, but also past productions and future opportunities, simply go to the HFC website. It's hfcc.edu. Do a search for theater, and you'll get to the Campus Life Theater page, where it proudly talks about how many talented artisans who've gone on and graduated and moved on to the pro life and moved on to university level. But the process here is that creative spark, and we are, you know, we've got it going strong at HFC. So we encourage you to check out Five Women Wearing the Same Dress, performing, you know, for the first time in a very long time at Henry Ford College's theater area. So Chris Bremer, you know, you again, when we started this interview, I said, you only pick winners, and this is going to be one of them again. So no pressure, but
no.
But it's going to be great. We're so grateful and excited that you've kept that spark of energy going, and we know it's going to be transformed onto that stage. So we wish you luck. We say thank you very much to you and your entire crew and cast for providing this entertainment opportunity for the community.
Let's break some legs. Eight performances, Thursday through Sunday, April 28th through May 1st. And again, Thursday through Sunday, May 5th through 8th. Evening performances, Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays. Afternoon matinees on Sundays. So 8 o'clock starts for Thursday through Saturday. And then 2 o'clock starts on both of those Sundays, April 28th through May 8th. Just look at a calendar. You'll figure it out. Or go to hfcc.edu and look at upcoming events. And I'm sure you will find it there. Christopher Bremer, thanks so much for being with us today on the WHFR Journal. Anything left to add or any other things that your last chance to say something about why people need to see this particular performance and just kind of how great it's going to be seeing the lights on and having people in an auditorium and back on stage?
Well, it's going to be a wonderful party, and I hope everyone will come and join us for this beautiful party. And it'll be a lot of fun, and I'm sure you will all be impressed. And Susan and Alan, thank you so much for reaching out. Such a pleasure to do this interview with you guys. And I look forward to seeing you all there, as well as all of our listeners. If you say you came because you saw this or you heard it on the radio, please tell us at the box office. We would love to know.
Okay. Yay.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
You're listening to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek along with Susan McGraw. Stay with us. We'll be here until 2 o'clock. Kitty Love comes up next, taking us on a trip down Highway 61. Some blues for your Friday afternoon here on WHFR Making Waves. Well, we've got more WHFR Journal. We'll make some waves of our own coming up next. So please do stay tuned.
Hello, guys and gals. I'm Dennis Brown II of Plymouth, Michigan. I've been spreading the word about autism awareness for more than a decade, and I'm doing it again this year. April is Autism Awareness Month. Do you know the risk factors for autism? What you're about to hear can surprise you. A parent's advanced age can become a risk. Pregnancies that are less than 1 year apart can also increase the risk of autism. Other risk factors include complications with pregnancy and childbirth, low birth weight, and even multiple pregnancies. Moms-to-be can help lower the risk by taking prenatal vitamins with folic acid. Learn the facts about autism. For more information, log on to autismspeaks.org.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. My name is Alan Mazurek with you until 2 o'clock here on the station Making Waves. Up next on our program, we're going to continue by recognizing National Poetry Month. The month of April, among other things, is National Poetry Month. And to round out our program today, we present a program from our friends at With Good Reason, talking about Walt Whitman. It's a program called Whitman at War. On a trip to see his brother during the Civil War, Walt Whitman was so struck by the violence of the Civil War that he stayed to help heal wounded soldiers working as a nurse. He hoped his poetry, just like his actions there, could help heal the war-torn nation in a similar way. Now, this program does date back a couple of years, which, so you know, the second half of the program is also going to talk about the 200th anniversary of Edgar Allan Poe's birth. Well, that took place a long time ago, back in 2009, which is when this program was produced. However, quite an interesting look at another facet of Walt Whitman and discussion of Edgar Allan Poe, celebrating National Poetry Month here on the WHFR Journal.
America, center of equal daughters.
This very early wire recording is thought to be of Walt Whitman himself reading his poem America. You can just make out the words strong, ample, fair, enduring.
Strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable.
Ezra Pound called Walt Whitman America's poet, and Whitman believed his poetry could heal the nation in the years leading up to the Civil War. And during the Civil War, Whitman actually devoted himself to healing thousands of wounded soldiers. He held them, dressed their wounds, wrote their letters home, and even spoon-fed them ice cream. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. Later on today's show, we're marking the 200th anniversary of another great American author, Edgar Allan Poe. While Poe's stories seem gloomy and depressing, he was actually a great idealist.
His famous horror stories are always, or nearly always, laced with a satiric and comic element that many people don't recognize.
But first, Walt Whitman is best known for the 1855 groundbreaking book of poems, Leaves of Grass. Mara Scanlon and Brady Earnhardt are fans of Whitman and professors of English at Mary Washington University in Fredericksburg, where Whitman first saw the violence of the Civil War. He spent the rest of the war nursing thousands of wounded soldiers back to health. Brady, let me start with you. What first gave him prominence as a writer? Was it Leaves of Grass?
There are a couple of ways of answering that. One is that the book he wrote that sold more copies of than anything else during his lifetime was his temperance novel, Franklin Evans, that he put out in 1842. But after that, there's this sort of historical black hole in the late 40s, and then all of a sudden, in 1855, he comes out with this groundbreaking book called Leaves of Grass. And it's so remarkable that Ralph Waldo Emerson, who is the highest paid lecturer in the country, who's one of these famous, famous figures, writes him a letter, I greet you at the beginning of a great career. It's the most famous letter in American literary history. And what does Whitman do? But he takes this letter and leaks it to friends of his in the press so that it gets published without Emerson's permission. Whitman goes further and publishes I Greet You at the Beginning of a Great Career on the spine of the second edition of Leaves of Grass in 1856.
He's a shameless self-promoter.
Yeah, that's one of those terrible contradictions, or wonderful contradictions, as the case may be, about Whitman.
So on one hand, we have Emerson saying, I greet you at the beginning of a fabulous career. And then you have prominent critics calling the work disgusting.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two things about it. One is that the form burst through what would be considered well-made poetry of the time in those long, lengthy, prosy lines of Whitman's. That would not have been seen as good poetry in a way. And then also the things he wrote about were inappropriate for what Brady was calling that kind of schlocky, sentimental poetry of the time. To make a list of Americans that includes not only the president and his cabinet, but also opium eaters and prostitutes. To write about sexuality, about slavery, about his own body. It's all material that would not have been seen as decorous, appropriate material for poetry.
Emily Dickinson's friend and sometime editor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, asked her if she'd read Walt Whitman's work, and she said, why, of course I haven't read it, but I've heard it's disgraceful. And anyway, one of the things that people found disgraceful was the way that Whitman talked about the female body, which he was trying to desensationalize and sort of de-smutify sex.
I think that's true of his discussion of the body altogether. And the individual human body comes to also stand for him for the national body, which he was very, very interested in speaking for and representing. And this passage I'm about to read talks about his desire to represent these people who otherwise are not represented in poetry. You hear how explicit he insists on what he's going to include. Through me, many long, dumb voices, voices of the interminable generations of slaves, voices of prostitutes and of deformed persons, voices of the diseased and despairing and of thieves and dwarves, through me, forbidden voices, voices of sexes and lusts, voices veiled, and I remove the veil. Copulation is no more rank to me than death is. Seeing, hearing, and feeling are miracles, and each part and tag of me is a miracle. The scent of these armpits is aroma finer than prayer. This head is more than churches or Bibles or creeds. And hear how revolutionary that claim is even today, and the sweeping rhetoric of that poetry. You can imagine it being declaimed, that the poetry might accomplish something that traditional politics, which he was getting less enamored of at that time, just weren't going to heal the nation the way the right poet might just do.
And the healing you're talking about is the build-up to the Civil War. The Civil War really changes him. What was his role during the Civil War?
Well, he was deeply concerned about the fracturing of the country that was happening in the years that led up to the Civil War. As it became clear that the South and the North were not going to reconcile without a fight, he became a staunch Unionist, and he actually, like a lot of people in the North, welcomed the war and became even sort of shockingly bloodthirsty war booster, because he saw that he thought of this as a process that was going to cleanse the country.
Whitman was initially drawn into the fighting areas of the Civil War by the wounding of his brother George, George Washington Whitman. But he was wounded at the Battle of Fredericksburg, where thousands and thousands of men died in a day because they were directed to march up from the river through what were then open plains. The Confederates were entrenched behind a wall and in very protected positions and just mowed them down. Walt Whitman and his mother saw George's name in a paper, realized he might be wounded but didn't know how, and Walt traveled to Fredericksburg to find his brother. He was very shocked to see the wounded there, spent a good part of the day in a large brick mansion on the banks of the Rappahannock, used as a hospital since the battle. Outdoors, at the foot of a tree, within 10 yards of the front of the house, I notice a heap of amputated feet, legs, arms, hands, etc., a full load for a one-horse cart. Several dead bodies lie near, each covered with its brown woolen blanket. And so he finds his brother there, spends a few days among the soldiers, heads to D.C., and essentially I think the best way to say it is he felt a calling to remain among the Civil War soldiers as he called himself a spiritual missionary, a soldier's missionary, he called himself a wound dresser to actually Confederate and Union soldiers in those hospitals for the next several years, for the duration of the war and beyond.
After the war, he wrote, "In my visits to the hospitals, I found it was in the simple matter of personal presence, an emanating ordinary cheer and magnetism, that I succeeded and helped more than by medical nursing or anything else." He would write letters to their moms for them. He would bring them tobacco or whiskey or
ice cream.
He would pet them. He would give them ice cream.
And he embraced them quite a bit. I mean, he records over and over, you know, "I sat with this man and I held his hand. I hugged him. I kissed him. I embraced him. They reach for me. They want me to kiss them and embrace them." Those soldiers came to represent for him a camaraderie that he saw as the best possible form of national unity and democracy. But then other times it becomes so personal. This section, for instance, is called "A Case from Second Bull Run." "Poor John Mahe is dead. He died yesterday. His was a painful and long, lingering case. The bladder had been perforated by a bullet going entirely through him. Not long since, I sat a good part of the morning by his bedside, Ward E, Armory Square. The water ran out of his eyes from the intense pain, and the muscles of his face were distorted, but he uttered nothing except a low groan now and then. Poor Mahe, a mere boy in age, but old in misfortune. He never knew the love of parents, was placed in his infancy in one of the New York charitable institutions, and subsequently bound out to a tyrannical master in Sullivan County, the scars of whose cowhide and club remained yet on his back. His wound here was a most disagreeable one, for he was a gentle, cleanly, and affectionate boy."
Whitman was what we would term now homosexual. How did his sexuality play into his experience nursing soldiers?
Oh, that's really sad, the sad story, because it was an occupational hazard when he was working in the hospitals to fall in love with soldiers. And he did so All the time. Fall in love is maybe an exaggeration. There were a couple of soldiers in particular, though, that he was very drawn to and who seemed to have been sort of uncertain as to how to respond. They weren't used to somebody coming on to them so strong. And one in particular named Tom Sawyer, Whitman seems to have pursued pretty diligently, and Walt would write him letters that said things like, "Tom, you know, didn't you get my last letter that had the self-addressed envelope on it?" Right. So he could write back and just, yeah, oh, it's so painful.
I agree with that. And yet I also think that that it is really pathetic at times. And then at other times, I think it's beautiful, because Brady was talking before about how he was living out what he had written about before. And here we find somebody who's relating to these suffering human beings with all of himself, his desire, his affection, his literary ability, his intellect.
Absolutely.
All of those things that he can bring to them, and he does all of it. And so while some soldiers record home in letters, you know, this uncle figure, fatherly figure, you know, one soldier uses the phrase, "He kissed me like a girl," or he, you know, "I kissed him for half, at least half a minute," you know. Yeah. But that doesn't seem to have disturbed most of them. I'm very moved by the physical and erotic nature of his relationship to those soldiers, which doesn't seem predatory to me. But
right. On the other hand, I think part of what makes it beautiful is the fact that it felt incomplete on some level, right? That's the
right.
Incompleteness is the soul of romance. And in some of his letters, Whitman says to these soldiers, to some of the, I think Tom Sawyer is mm-hmm. one of them, he says, "I will never be truly happy unless you and I are living under the same roof, and, you know, maybe we can find a farm somewhere," that kind of thing, which of course never happened.
Mm. It's such a shame, isn't it, that most of us who aren't scholars have our first introduction to Whitman and maybe the card game Authors. There you see this imposing bearded figure, and you uh-huh. think, I don't know who the heck Walt Whitman is, but it can't be great.
Yeah. Right. He seems like a little bit of a, you know, a nut job. And
we should redo that deck of cards.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's true of so much about literature. I think that sometimes students and other readers forget that every reader can do the same thing to a piece of literature, can make it breathe.
There's something about Whitman's, though, that's more so than I think other authors. Robert Louis Stevenson, I think it was, said that Whitman was able to make you feel, as you read one of his poems, like he was standing over your shoulder, looking down with you at the text. His work is full of phrases like, "Listener up there, come closer to me, loaf with me on the grass," and this really famous passage. This is from a poem called "So Long." "From behind the screen where I hid, I advance personally. Camarado, this is no book. Who touches this, touches a man. Is it night? Are we here alone? It is I you hold, and who holds you? I spring from the pages into your arms. Decease calls me forth." This idea of who touches this, touches a man. You know, you do feel like, oh, this is a person that I have here.
Brady, you perform a song as a singer and guitar player called Whitman in 1863. That's a song whose words, I'm guessing, are letters from Whitman.
The gist of it is he's writing a letter to Tom Sawyer, this soldier that he's infatuated with, maybe in love with, and it's not the first letter he's written, and he kind of knows that Tom's not going to write back. And he knows that Tom is not going to return the kind of love that he has.
It's interesting to have such a personal song, a love song, in the midst of the national schism.
Yes.
But it does, I mean, it gets to a lot of what we've been saying about Whitman in the midst of the Civil War, that is that he understood himself both to be a wound dresser to the nation as a whole, who could find in his poetry a new map for how to proceed, and also that on the most intimate level, he straightened the collars and wrote the letters and fed the ice cream, you know, to individuals, and understood that in some ways something we all have to be willing to do if we're going to survive as a nation, I think. That is, you can't always change things on a national scale, but sometimes you can spoon some ice cream to the sick and tired person next to you.
Brady Earnhardt and Mara Scanlon are professors of English at the University of Mary Washington. With their colleague James Groom, they're working on Looking for Whitman, a digital humanities project. For a link, visit our website at withgoodreasonradio.org. Coming up next, Edgar Allan Poe at 200.
A crowd came in last week from Fredericksburg. I met a soldier close to you. Brought the sniper's ball that missed your charming head the day the bridge you built went through. I think of you by some campfire sleeping or lying in your tent wake, thinking out how you might write me what you couldn't say.
Edgar Allan Poe was born 200 years ago and only lived to the age of 40, but in his short life he wrote stories and poems with far-reaching influence. Jerome McGann is a professor of English at the University of Virginia. He says although Poe's stories seem gloomy and depressing, he was actually a great idealist, constantly searching for the beautiful and the sublime. So he was born Edgar Poe, but then adopted by the relatively wealthy Mr. Allen.
Well, his mother and father, his birth mother and father, were actors, but they died when he was young, and he was then adopted by Mr. Allen.
So he became Edgar Allan Poe, and Allen cared for him a great deal, right? He just eventually became disgusted with his wayward ways?
Well, it's a complicated situation. It all began when he was at the University of Virginia. Allen was fearful that Poe would become involved with drinking and with a fast life there, gambling and so forth. The University of Virginia at that time was, in fact, infamous for allowing its young men to misbehave in these ways. And indeed, when Poe was there, he got involved with gambling and drinking and so forth. That's where his drinking problem began. And the consequence was that Poe was continually in need of money. Allen gave it grudgingly and finally just stopped giving it, and they had a break.
What do you make of the fact that he married a cousin, a 13-year-old?
Well, that's a good example of the kind of idealism that he had. One of the major influences on his life was Lord Byron, and Byron had a similar kind of attachment to his half-sister. These kinds of attachments exhibit a form of idealism that is a major characteristic of both Byron and Poe.
It's so interesting because his actual upbringing was rather refined and his education was refined. And yet we think of him as having lived this debauched life on one level.
That is true. He was raised well and educated well, although his adoptive father cut him off, and that began a life of extreme poverty. There probably was no major writer in the 19th century who was so perpetually impoverished as Poe was.
In the popular mind, Edgar Allan Poe's forever the intense, brooding man in that portrait that we all see. Was he the Stephen King of his time, or was his literary legacy much more than that?
Well, the most famous genre that he is said to be the creator of is the detective story. He is probably the first great short story writer in the world. So his influence on all later short story writing is immense. And, of course, in the literature of the Gothic, horror literature, literature of terror and that sort of thing, is very, very important. Probably no American writer, with the perhaps the exception of James Fenimore Cooper, had a greater international reputation than Poe.
And why was that? Who was championing him abroad?
First of all, Baudelaire. He was completely obsessed with Poe. And after Baudelaire, then came Mallarmé, who was equally obsessed with Poe. and then into the 20th century Valéry. So in terms of, for example, French poetical history, you probably can't get a more influential triad of figures than Baudelaire, Mallarmé, and Valéry.
What was it about Poe that held them in such thrall?
The drunkenness and alcoholism is closely related to Baudelaire and Mallarmé's understanding of Poe. The figure of the cursed poet, the poet maudit, was very, very influential, important for the cultural period of the late 19th and early 20th century. And Poe was seen as the paradigmatic cursed poet.
And of course, then dying young as he did just sort of added to the mystique for them?
Indeed. Almost an allusion to the famous ancient proverb, whom the gods love, die young.
And what did they love about his take on life?
They loved his pursuit of the impossible and the beautiful beyond this world of material forms. And the best way I can talk about this is to quote part of a famous passage from a very famous essay that he wrote called The Poetic Principle. An immortal instinct deep within the spirit of man is thus plainly a sense of the beautiful. We have still a thirst unquenchable to allay, which even the poet has not shown us, the crystal springs. It is the desire of the moth for the star. It is no mere appreciation of the beauty before us, but a wild effort to reach the beauty above. The sense that Poe always gives in his writing is that there is a barrier and a bar that is always standing in the way of this pursuit of the impossible.
You've written something about Poe that fascinates me. You say he understood, as few have, that fear of the unknown is related to our human desire for beauty. Help me understand how.
The point is really wonderfully laid out in a passage that I might read. This is how it goes. If any ambitious man have a fancy to revolutionize at one effort the universal world of human thought, opinion, and human sentiment, all he has to do is to write and publish a very little book. Its title should be simple, a few plain words, My Heart Laid Bare. But this little book must be true to its title. No man dare write it. No man ever will dare write it. No man could write it. This led Baudelaire, in fact, to try to write such a book, Mon Coeur Mis à Nu, which was a kind of journal in which he tried to lay bare this heart. But this heart is inaccessible.
That's really wonderful, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Did he have a sort of depressed and morbid an outlook, as so many of his stories and poems would suggest?
On the contrary. He was a famous conversationalist. He was high-spirited. He was a great comic writer. And his famous horror stories are always, or nearly always, laced with a satiric and comic element that many people don't recognize.
Give me an example.
All right, a very famous one, The Fall of the House of Usher. This is how it begins. During the whole of a dull, dark, and soundless day in the autumn of the year, when the clouds hung oppressively low in the heavens, I had been passing alone on horseback through a singularly dreary tract of country, and at length found myself, as the shades of the evening drew on, within view of the melancholy House of Usher. I know not how it was, but with the first glimpse of the building, a sense of insufferable gloom pervaded my spirit. Now, I'm going to stop there and say, when he writes, I know not how it was, and then you sort of think back across the passage that you just read, you have to almost laugh to not recognize that you know perfectly well how it was, because it has been described in this particular way.
What was his adult personality like? Was he a braggart? Was he well-liked? Did he have friends?
It was said of him, famously by a malicious critic of his, that he had no friends and that when he died, no one would mourn him because he had no friends to mourn him, although many would regret that he was gone because he was such a brilliant man. I think it probably would be fair to say that among the men he knew during his lifetime, there were very few people whom he could call his friends, and perhaps none. On the other hand, there were a great many women, his wife, his mother-in-law, other women as well, who were deeply attached to him. His commitment to this extreme idealism of the beautiful is a function of a sense that in this world you can never attain this. So there is a constant sense of pain, frustration, even despair that runs through all his work. Paradoxically, of course, is the constant sense of the comedy of it all.
How did Poe die?
It's quite mysterious. He died in Baltimore. No one really knows. There are many, many stories, and they all conflict. But he was found unconscious in the street and was taken into a hospital. Some people say he was completely drunk. Some people say he was beaten to death. And some people say both things are true. Other people say neither of these things were true. It's probably important to recall that very few writers lived lives that one would find exemplary if you were interested in moral values. There seems to be a curse laid upon writers that sends them to different kinds of extremes. So Wagner, Byron, it doesn't matter. The life of an artist is not to be thought of as a place where you turn for moral instruction. You go to an artist for these kinds of works that an artist will produce in order to throw up what has been famously called a mirror to our own lives. That is what their art is about.
Well, Jerome McGann, thank you for talking with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Jerome McGann is a professor of English at the University of Virginia. UVA's Special Collections Library is currently exhibiting From Out That Shadow, The Life and Legacy of Edgar Allan Poe, a collection of letters and artifacts from Poe's life. For more information, visit withgoodreasonradio.org. You're listening to With Good Reason. Elliot Majerzyk and Jesse Dukes are our associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Nancy King creates our feature capsules. Jeannie Palin handles listener services, and Lydia Wilson is our publicity coordinator. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities for the Higher Education Broadcasting Consortium. For a free copy of this show on CD, call 877-451-5098 or subscribe to our podcast at withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Wrapping up today's edition of the WHFR Journal, celebrating National Poetry Month, Whitman at War, and a look back at the 200th anniversary of Edgar Allan Poe's birth. That'll do it for our program today. Kitty Love up next, taking us on a trip down Highway 61 here for your Friday afternoon. From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, online as well at WHFR.FM, making waves.
Henry Ford College's Theater Arts Program invites you to join them in welcoming